I've used the image we did before, Beethoven's late quartet. Some people have compared these writings of Lonergan to Beethoven's late quartets, sort of the mature. So this is just three. Is that going over to? Okay. Coming to maturity in so many different themes, and you see that. So let's go then. Philosophy and the religious phenomena. As I said, Jeff is not going to be here, so we can begin. So the question that this particular lecture addresses is, how does philosophy view the religious phenomena in terms of its viability or validity? Can philosophy make any statements with regard to the religious phenomena? The interesting thing about this paper is that no one knew that it ever existed until after Lonergan's death, and we discovered it among his papers. But he obviously wrote it for a conference, because he starts it out by saying
the question suggested for the symposium.
So as Fred and it seems pretty clear from internal evidence that the date footnote there gives you the internal evidence, at least as Fred Crowe interpreted it. So it was probably for the conference on contemporary religious consciousness held at Carleton University, Ottawa, October 1978. But Lonergan eventually ended up substituting his earlier paper, Prolegomena to the Study of the Emerging Religious Consciousness of Our Time, which he had given in Vienna a couple of years earlier. He gave that again in Ottawa. Why is a good question. I'm not sure why. Maybe he just didn't want to go out with this. Did everybody have a copy of the notes? Maybe he didn't want to go public saying that there were six levels of consciousness. I don't know. Anyway, it's one of the most interesting parts of the paper as far as I'm concerned. Because I had an article claiming that there was a fifth level, and then I was attacked. So I have come back to my attacker and said, "Have you seen that book? It says there are six levels." So my attacker will go on me.
We all know him.
Yes. Okay. Anyway, the first part of the lecture seems concerned with establishing the validity and limits of a philosophy of religion. So can philosophy say anything about religion? Does it have any role in that at all? And, of course, if it's a scholastic philosophy, the answer is no. Because within and I can remember being taught this back in St. Louis. What is all this stuff, philosophy of this and philosophy of that and philosophy of that and so on and so forth? Philosophy is logic, cosmology, metaphysics, rational psychology, epistemology, that we've had to do that because there have been some questions raised about that in the last couple of centuries. But philosophy isn't philosophy of anything. And above all, it can't be philosophy of religion, because there's only one true religion, and that's Christianity. And Christianity is supernatural, and philosophy deals with nature. So philosophy can't say anything about that. It just leaves it all to theology. So that was the scholastic or neo-scholastic position on this. Very different, of course, from Thomas's own position on the role of philosophy in theology, because for him there was no separation at all between the two. He used philosophy in doing theology, and he didn't divide the two into separate compartments where one deals with this nature and the other. His whole work was theology, and he used philosophy to help him develop theology, and particularly to give him a systematic framework within which he could develop theology in his own day. So at any rate, within the scholastic view, there could not be such a thing even as a philosophy, there could not even be a philosophy of religion, much less Could religion say anything about the viability? Could philosophy say anything about the viability or validity of religion? So that pretty well sums up the number two there. I don't think we need to read everything in number two. I think that's basically the point. So if philosophy means what it's meant in the scholastic tradition as that developed, or perhaps maybe not developed, but declined from Aquinas, then no, there can't be anything. There can't be a philosophy of religion. So Lonergan says, well, if you don't accept that position, and I don't, then what do you do? Well, number one is here in, under number three, actually. For Lonergan, you start out by saying philosophy must honor an empirical principle. There is always required some empirical element. So something from experience in any judgment of fact, or any judgment of possibility, or any judgment of probability. So whether in common sense, or in science, or mathematics, or philosophy, you've got to point to something in experience. And so that's where you start. You start with experience. Philosophy, for Lonergan, this means the three basic questions of what he here is calling foundational methodology. What am I doing when I'm knowing? Well, that's all empirical. You know, we have sensations, we ask questions, we get insights, we formulate concepts, further questions, and so on and so forth. But you can point to every one of those things in experience, in the data of consciousness. You can point to every one of the things that he's talking about. So philosophy is empirical. And then its next question, why are those operations knowing? Why aren't they just dreaming or whatever? So epistemology. And then finally, what do I know when I do that? So the basic questions have not changed for him over time. Those are the three basic questions. They were the three basic questions at the time of insight, and they still are the three basic questions in composing a theology. That doesn't mean there aren't more questions, but you start there, and you start with the self-appropriation of the cognitional operations. So this philosophy is not scholastic philosophy. It's what he here calls foundational methodology, and he makes several points about it. First, it covers all that is basic in philosophy, at least in the sense that one cannot cover any other issues in philosophy without settling first the issues of cognitional theory, epistemology, and metaphysics. So those are the basic questions. Second, from this standpoint, metaphysics is not the first science, as it was for Aristotle and for the whole scholastic tradition, including Thomas, I think. For philosophy is concerned primarily not with objects, but with operations. And so the first science, or the grounding element in philosophy, has to be the element that examines the operations of the subject. What is most basic, then, is cognitional theory. And there follows the issue of the validity of the operations, and that's the concern of epistemology. And then in the third place, the question of objects, which is the concern of metaphysics. So it's operations before objects. This shift, number six here, thirdly, this shift allows us both to retain the scholastic distinction between naturally known objects and supernaturally known objects, which certainly was a distinction for Thomas, and yet to deprive it of the absolute priority that it took in the scholastic context, the priority that divided knowledge into knowledge of things that we know naturally and knowledge of things that we know by revelation or supernaturally or by grace or however we would explain it. Well, if you're starting from experience, okay, and there's this empirical principle, the first thing is the three basic operations of experiencing, understanding, and judging. But if you're starting from the empirical principle, well, there's nothing that rules out the experience of something supernatural. So experience in the religious domain as well as in the domain of natural cognitive operations. So there is the possibility of the experience of grace, and so there's the possibility that perhaps philosophy has something to say about grace, at least might have something to say or might have some help to give to talking about it. So fourthly then, number seven, this shift is from logic to method. We've seen that over and over and over again in this course. How he emphasizes the movement from logic to method. It's also a shift from particular systems in their clarity, coherence, and rigor to movement. Movement in thought. Movement out of non-system into system. Movement from one system to a better system. Again, within a purely logical framework, the idea of moving from one system to a better system doesn't make any sense because your system defines everything at the very beginning and then draws all its conclusions from that. So if you're talking about moving from one system to a better system, which is what science does and which is what Lonergan is claiming that systematic theology, even through all the years, has done, and of course must do that today. But anyway, that's the shift. So the conclusions to be drawn in the first part of the lecture, where he asked the question about the validity and limits of a philosophy of religion, are the following. Since philosophy is now identified with foundational methodology, there no longer holds the peremptory scholastic argument against a sound philosophy of religion. There could be a philosophy that says something about religion, especially when you're starting with the empirical principle and you're talking about the states and operations of the subject. Next, as philosophy is foundational methodology, so philosophy of religion is the foundational methodology of religious studies. This is the first place, to my knowledge, where he's actually said this is what he would mean by a philosophy of religion. It would be the foundational methodology of religious studies. I'll come back to this anyway. And thirdly, a foundational methodology of religious studies, while it's able to pronounce on the viability or validity of this or that method of religious studies, but in itself, it would go beyond its competence if it tried to pronounce on the non-methodological aspects of religious studies, such as the viability or validity of a particular religion, or the viability or validity of the results of religious studies. So what a philosophy of religion is able to comment on is the viability or validity of a method of studying religious data. Beyond that, philosophy has to yield to theology. If it's going to be talking about the viability or validity of a particular religion or a particular way of living out a religion, it has to take up a stance from within that religious framework, and it has to become theological. Okay? Are we clear up to that point, what he's doing? All right, second part. Oh, what I wanted to say was it was Jim Canaris's book called Lonergan's Philosophy of Religion, which I reviewed for, and it was just a short book, so they asked me just to do a short review, and I wanted to do a long review because I was interested in the book, but I had to keep it short, in theological studies. But it was there that where Canaris was the one who emphasized this notion of philosophy of religion as the foundational methodology of religious studies, and I hadn't picked that up yet in Lonergan's work. That's the fundamental meaning of philosophy of religion for him. There are also theological views that he presents on religion and so on and so forth. But this meaning of philosophy of religion as foundational methodology of religious studies. Okay, the second part of the lecture takes the argument a step further. The priority of metaphysics implied a faculty psychology, sensation, imagination, intellect, will. A psychology in terms of potencies, forms, and acts. A psychology that in its ultimate terms and relations was not empirical. All right, we don't have we have an experience of acts of willing, but we don't have an experience of a faculty called will. Right? So we have experience of acts of understanding, but we don't have an experience of a faculty called intellect. So there goes my intellect.
Oh no!
We have experience of the operations, but we don't have experience of the faculty. So the scholastic, again, the priority of metaphysics implying this faculty psychology, a psychology in terms of potencies, forms, and acts, but once the priority of metaphysics is rejected, so too is this implication of a faculty psychology. When philosophy is conceived as a foundational methodology, and when cognitional theory is its basic step, the empirical principle demands that cognitional theory take its stand on the data of cognitional consciousness. But cognitional consciousness is of operations and of the normative tendencies linking operations together. It's not consciousness of faculties like will and even imagination. It's we're conscious of images. We're not conscious of a faculty called imagination. That doesn't mean there isn't one, but it's just that this is not the center stage. Cognitional theory, accordingly, will consist of terms and relations, where the terms name operations and the relations name normative tendencies, from acts of sensing to questions, from questions to insights, from insights to concepts, from concepts to further questions, and so on. So in this fashion, faculty psychology gives way to an intentionality analysis. Okay, that's basic, but what's the import of it, and particularly for the present question? Well, first of all, the endlessly debated questions in the scholastic tradition. What's more important? Sensation, intellect, will. All of these questions are automatically settled, he says, by comparing levels of operations linked by the operators that are manifested by questions. So operators are the questions. It's the questions that move you from one level to the next. So the relation between successive levels is sublation, where sublating operations go beyond the sublated, introduce something radically new, respect the integrity of the sublated, and bestow upon them a higher significance and a wider relevance. So, for instance, the act of understanding, it includes everything that has been sensed and imagined and so on, and it lifts it up to a higher level by unifying it through some kind of meaning. Okay, but you don't sense meaning, you don't imagine meaning, you understand meaning. You get meaning through understanding. But that meaning integrates what before was sensation, image, emotion, and so on. So sublation. And then judgment will integrate at a higher level, at a more unified level, one's various acts of understanding, where they all come together in an affirmation. And then finally, decision integrates knowing and feeling in the higher synthesis of existential operation. So sublation. Sublating operations go beyond what is sublated, introduce something radically new, respect the integrity of the sublated, and bestow upon the sublated a higher significance and a wider relevance. So he shows how this occurs through questions for intelligence, questions for reflection, questions for deliberation. And so the old questions of sensism, intellectualism, sentimentalism, voluntarism, and so on vanish. What comes first? Intellect or will, and so on. Experience, understanding, judgment, and decision all are essential to human living. While all are essential and none can be dropped or even slighted, still the successive levels are related in as much as the later presuppose the earlier and complement them, and in as much as the earlier are ordained to the later and need them to attain their human significance. So, all of that we're probably familiar with. We've studied enough of Lonergan and even the earlier Lonergan to be familiar with all of that stuff. But now he's making some applications, and then I think he's also doing this to set up his third part, where he's going to introduce the two other levels. Several notes and corollaries are added. First, the meaning of the successive levels is not spatial or chronological. I've commented on this any number of times in my classes here that we've been using a spatial image, but that doesn't mean that understanding is spatially different from sensation, and that judgment is spatially different. It's just a metaphor. Nor does it necessarily mean that they're chronological, in the sense that you can have all of them going on at once. Okay. But the meaning of the successive levels is in terms of sublation and sublated operations. Secondly, number 12, complaints about the one-sidedness of an exclusive intellectualism are justified But that doesn't mean that intellectualist products can be dismissed as just abstractions. Lonergan walks a fine line here between, on the one hand, an excessive intellectualism, and on the other hand, an anti-intellectualism. Okay, the excessive intellectualism would be the thing that would be the position that did not take seriously in human life images, feelings, and decisions as being every bit as important as cognitional operations. But an anti-intellectualism would be one that said, well, you know, let's just feel or whatever, and not paying any attention to. And everything that comes from intellect is an abstraction. Well, he says that isn't true. That's not true. The so-called abstract is usually the incompletely determined apprehension of the concrete. And all human apprehension is incompletely determined. So almost any statement we make is, in a sense, abstract, because we're not taking in everything. And, he says, indeed, intellectualist apprehension, and apprehension that results from solid inquiry and insight and reflection and judgment, is more complete than the apprehensions of undifferentiated consciousness. And so it's closer to the concrete. And it's just the ignorance of undifferentiated consciousness that complains that everything intellectual is abstract. You know, I get angry when I hear people say, well, Lonergan's so abstract. He's not. He isn't. You know, he's complete. He's as comprehensive a thinker as I've ever read. He tries to cover just about everything. But that doesn't make him abstract. He's difficult. But he's not leaving things out. He's trying to provide a heuristic for just about everything. So that's not abstract, except in the sense that if it's incomplete, it is abstract. But everything we do is incomplete. But thirdly, and this is getting closer to the issue of religion, this analysis also reveals the significance of the existential, the level of deliberation, decision, action, which is both practical in the sense that it affects other people and it affects things and changes situations and so on, but also it's existential. And he has this meaning of existential in the sense of Jaspers existens, the subject, in that moment where the subject realizes it's up to himself or herself to decide what they're going to make of themselves. So the two aspects of this level, practical and existential, are linked. Any practical decision, the decision to study theology, practical decision, reveals and confirms and intensifies the authenticity or unauthenticity of the subject who made the decision. And any existential decision, I am going to make every effort to be a kinder person. So a decision that really focuses on myself attains its substance and moment only in the measure that it transforms my conduct, my pursuits, and hence my relationship to other people and to situations. So the existential and the practical are linked together. Fourthly, a foundational methodology can function as a philosophy of religion only by moving beyond the levels of experience, understanding, and judgment, and including the higher significance and relevance of deliberation, evaluation, decision, and action. For every religion, so notice now, remember, a foundational methodology, philosophy of religion is a foundational methodology for religious studies. And so it's going to take into account what he's saying in this fourth point, not only data and understanding of the data and judgments of whether you've understood the data correctly, but it's going to take into account the relevance of the existential, what religion does to transform human living. So it will be in every religion is involved in value judgments, and so every study of religion must take into account what the value judgments are that are operative in a particular religion. And even to judge that the object of religious belief should be believed is a value judgment. It's the only, this is just a side thing, I've been doing a little bit of research lately on judgment of value or value judgment in Lonergan. And the phrase judgment of value occurs only in one place, in insight. And that is in this discussion of belief in chapter 20. It's the only place where he uses the expression judgment of value, where I reach the decision, where I make a judgment of value that it is worthwhile to believe something that somebody else has told me. But that's the only place where he uses the expression judgment of value in the whole book, Insight. I was really surprised because I thought it would definitely be in the chapter on ethics. Judgment is mentioned in the chapter on ethics, but not judgment of value. And in fact, judgment of value does not emerge as a distinctly separate category until quite late in his thinking. Which leads me to think that until he came to see that there are at least two different ways of making decisions. There is the way that he talked about in Insight where you're a good decision is one that is in harmony with what you know is right. Okay? But what you know is right, the judgment there is more a judgment, the way he's talking about it at least, more of a judgment of fact than as a judgment of value. So the only thing that is fourth level is the actual decision in insight itself. Now, in St. Ignatius's methods for making decisions, there is his third moment of making decision, which I think is very similar to the method that Lonergan proposes in Insight. When you're not being pulled in different directions affectively, what do? You sit down and you take out a piece of paper and you write down, you have to make a decision about something. And so you say, all right, I could do this. And then you write down the pros and you write down the cons and you weigh them against each other rationally and you go with what seems best. And then you have to test it affectively. It has to leave you with a peaceful conscience and all of that sort of thing. But the way you do it is through a process of rational self-consciousness, the terms that Lonergan uses in Insight. So that is one way of making decisions, and Ignatius acknowledges it, and I think in Insight, Lonergan is talking about that way of making decisions. But in that way of making decisions, the only thing that is beyond knowing is that the actual decision. And so the only thing that's fourth level is the actual decision. Sitting down and writing out the pros and cons and all of this sort of thing, that's all experience, understanding, and judgment. Those are all knowing activities, okay, cognitive activities. But then there's another mode of making decisions, and I think it's only when Lonergan came to acknowledge this other mode that he put much more into the fourth level of consciousness. All of discernment goes into the fourth level. When you can't sit down calmly and write out the pros and cons because you're agitated and you're being pulled in many different directions and you don't have the tranquility to do things that way. So then Ignatius says, what do you have to do? You have to see where the different pulls and counterpulls are leading you. So you have to follow your affect. See where it's taking you. Is it taking you to what's good? Is it taking you to what's not good? Is it taking you to self-transcendence? Lonergan's terms now, it's not Ignatius, but just talking about the same thing. Is it carrying you to self-transcendence in a joyful, peaceful way? Or is it like fingernails on a blackboard? Or water dropping on a rock? Not a sponge, but a rock. Then it's not good. Okay. So that's, Lonergan came to see later in life that, sometimes we make decisions that way. And that gave him a lot of stuff in the fourth level of consciousness, all the discernment things. Where are my feelings taking me? What values are being apprehended in feelings, and what does this mean, and so on and so forth. That's all existential deliberation, evaluation, discernment. So all of that, in the second mode of making election or decision in the Ignatius' terms, that's all fourth level stuff, not just the decision. But all of the weighing the discerning of where my affect is taking me. Okay? The discernment of spirits. Yes.
So, Bob, is it only a judgment of value and feelings when affect is involved?
Is it only
a judgment of value when your affect is involved?
Well, I think this is where, I don't want to go that far, but I think it was within that context that he realized the importance of judgment of value, where it became a much more extensive category than just the one instance in Insight, which is at the very end of the book where he's talking about that I make a judgment that it is worthwhile to believe what somebody else has told me. That's the only place where he uses the expression judgment of value and insight, whereas in Method it starts right at the beginning of the book in chapter 2. So at least the category of judgment of value emerged for him as an important category when he began to see that the method of making decisions that he had presented in Insight was not the only method. The judgments that were involved in that method were still really judgments of fact, you know. They weren't really judgments of value. Now, maybe they are judgments of value, but he didn't talk about them that way. He talked about them as cognitive judgments. So there's a lot still to be done about sorting out the fourth level, I think. So I'm just offering you here, actually, my latest thinking on this. I had been pretty clear, well, you saw in the paper on Ignatius and Lonergan the thing of the two methods that he presented, insight and method, correspond to the third mode of Ignatius, insight, and the second mode of Ignatius, method. I'm sure that that's true, and I've held that position probably for about 15 years, and nobody's really argued against it. But that fourth level emerges with his awareness of this second mode of making decisions. There's a lot of stuff that we do by when we follow where affect is taking us that is a lot different from experience, understanding, judgment, cognitive kinds of things. We have to, yeah, it's a kind of, well, it's discernment. It doesn't mean that experiencing, understanding, and judging aren't involved. They are, but they're within a whole new context of discernment heading towards a judgment of value and then a decision. Yes.
Taking into consideration what you just said in the article you wrote, I have a question, and you're like the person who has worked most in that area. Going through the meditations proposed by Progrov and sometimes doing some of the exercises of focusing, yes, it looks like feelings, you have a capacity to be with your feelings and to recognize them.
Yes.
And is that when you do that and when you make a decision according to this feelings you have after going through the exercises, it looks like after you go through the meditation you're at peace and the feelings are not disordered. Mm-hmm. It looks like you have a clarity and you have also an intellectual clarity, mm-hmm, about what's going on. Mm-hmm. What is that? Which one of the two is which of the two discernments are those? The one that's coming with what you know, or is it the second one you mentioned? The one where their feelings are saying to me, where I should go?
I think it's the second. If I understand what you were talking about, I think it's the second. I think it's I want to be careful here with using first, second, and third, because there's Ignatius. There's the first mode of making a decision is where you get knocked over the head by God and there's just no question. You know, St. Paul on the way to Damascus, you know, there were no further questions. You know, you get knocked off your horse, it's pretty clear. And sometimes we can make decisions that way. It's more common than we might. Then Ignatius would make us think it is by giving an example like St. Paul being knocked off his horse. There are times where you just know, that's it. There are no further questions. But Then his second mode is where you're agitated, and you have to follow the affect and see where it goes. And the third mode is, well, you have to make a decision, but you're really not being pulled in different directions, and so you do the cognitive thing. Now, the second and third modes must complement each other, so that if you've made a decision by following affect, discernment of spirits, you also have to be able to rationally account for it. It has to make sense. If it's really stupid, you know. Now, it might be outrageous. Jim Loney might have made a decision that way to go to Iraq, but believe me, he was able to give solid reasons for why he was going. Okay, so he was able to cognitively adjudicate it. Right? On the other hand, if you make a decision on the basis of cognitive operations, it has to leave you with a peaceful conscience when there's something wrong with it. If it leaves you with, you know, then start over. You know? Does that help?
So does a judgment of value then include a judgment of fact usually?
Yes.
Okay.
It definitely it rests on that because it, the judgment of value for that you have to know what the situation is.
Okay.
And the knowing of the situation is the judgment of fact. Or know what, maybe a lot of judgments of fact, like know what your weaknesses and strengths are. Those are judgments of fact, you know. And it might be best, what might be good for one person might not be good for you because of traps that you can fall into that the other person doesn't fall into, or at least, you know, all of us are kind of,
yeah.
But those are all judgments of fact.
I have a quick question that I flagged here that I think we're at right now, and it's just that he says here, in like manner, questions for deliberation sublate the previous three levels. They are concerned with the good. They end the one-sidedness of purely cognitional endeavor to restore the integration of sense and cognition, thought and feeling. That's it. But I was thinking that the psyche is the dramatic aesthetic
mm-hmm.
pattern
mm-hmm.
in all of our operations,
mm-hmm.
and that includes feelings.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like he's saying that, you know, experience, understanding, judgment, feelings aren't involved, that it's purely cognitive.
Well, okay, he might be giving some kind of in a sense, incompleteness and so abstraction there, because you know there are elsewhere. He's very clear that feelings are the massive momentum of our cognition operations, and without feelings, our understanding and judgment would be paper thin.
Right.
So it definitely it's the dramatic aesthetic permeates everything. But he does also say, in the same context in Method, where he says this about feelings, he also says that it's at the fourth level where feeling and knowing and feeling are integrated in decision. In the way they're consciously integrated in decision, in good decision. Good decisions integrate what you know and your affect.
Okay.
Yeah. So all of that to do with the fourth level. So, and that's where, so any philosophy of religion has got to be open to the fact that there is a fourth level of consciousness, because that's what religion is concerned about to a large extent. Are we okay up to that point? Because
I just want to clarify, just now you said that the levels of operations, they don't have to be chronological necessarily.
I think I have to qualify what I said there. The meaning of talking about the levels is not chronological. The meaning is sublation. So it's not... there was some other place, too, where he said the differential is not time. Oh, I know where it is. It's in an early version of his methodological reflections on systematic theology, where... In theology, there's one instance, at least, where judgments precede understanding. because systematic theology is an attempt to understand what I already have affirmed to be true, the doctrines of the church. Okay. So, or whatever, my doctrines. They might be the doctrines of the church, they might be my doctrines, but at least they're doctrines which I've already affirmed. And then in systematics, I try to understand them in a much more integrated fashion than I did before. So that's an instance where judgment has preceded a certain type of understanding. And so he says the differential is not time. The differential between these, like for most of the time, he says it right in this kind of, most of the time, understanding precedes judgment. But I can also attempt to have a fuller understanding of what I've already judged to be the case. And in that case, understanding is following judgment. But the differential is in terms of what is the operation about. Is it about a firm affirmation, yes or no, or is it about answering a question, well, what does this mean? If it's about what does this mean, it's an understanding. It's for understanding. And then, you see, in systematic theology, you have, all right, you have the creed, all right, and or you have the Nicene dogma, which I affirm in doctrines. Then I attempt to understand it in systematics, so in that sense, judgment is following, understanding is following judgment. But also, not any understanding will do. So I want my understanding to be as good as possible, so there's another judgment that's following the understanding. Mm-hmm. You know, is this the best that I can do, the best that I can come up with? You know?
Is there a space where you can say, you can speak of an ontological unfolding, and so affirm that in fact, at some level of human experience, you have to follow these.
Yeah, you do.
So, I mean, so it's not just.
No, I mean, there are. You do have to follow them, but remember too that they can also unfold from above downwards, and in that sense, there can be. I can be. I can start with judgments of value that follow upon love. And then within that framework, that can change my judgments of fact and my understanding of things and affect the way I feel and sense. So it can go that way.
But even in that direction, would you not have experienced and then understood the situation and then made a judgment, yes?
Yeah, I think that it's...
So, you kind of...
It goes both ways.
Yeah. Because I'm trying to...
I mean, you're starting with the experience of love, you know. Well, that's experience. But it's experience, and yet it's not just empirical consciousness, you know, because it includes a lot of the other stuff, too. It includes a lot of value and so on. Again, the thing, I'm not trying, looking for an easy way out of a difficult question here. There's still a lot of work to be done on how the ontological unfolding from above downwards happens. You know, he opened it up for us, but he didn't spell it out the way that the other one is spelled out in such intricate detail. And there's still a lot to be done in the other one, though, too. You know. I mean, I'm convinced, as the paper on reception and elemental meaning says, that Heidegger has an awful lot to tell us about that interrelationship of experience and understanding, which Lonergan was onto when he got into the hermeneutical turn. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think we can learn a lot from Heidegger and Gadamer about that.
I have another question that's related to this.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of what's the relationship between the operations that Lonergan is speaking of and the eidetic intuition that the phenomenological description is trying to get at, and therefore what's the difference between a foundational methodology for in religious studies and a phenomenology of religion. It seems like in phenomenology you stop short of the explanatory self-appropriation of things as related to each other. I mean, you don't get there. It's a description of how things are related to us, and just trying to stay with that, it seems to me.
That's probably correct. So, but I'd have to do some more thinking about that. But I think that's probably correct. There's also the statement that he made in a kind of anticipatory way of the need for a phenomenology of reflection and judgment in a way that the phenomenologists haven't pushed it that far yet. But anyway, let me do some more thinking about that. All right, let's see if we can finish this one before... No, we can't finish it before 3 because we've got another couple of pages. But I do want to get into the third part. The third part of the lecture acknowledges then, and this was what I found obviously most exciting about the whole thing, because I think it's the first... Well, it's not the first... It's not the first time where he said that there's an openness on the upper end, but it's the first time that he's more open to the kind of thing that I was suggesting in the psychic conversion than he is anywhere else, because he actually speaks about it here as operator. Remember earlier, the language was quasi-operator.
Like, doesn't he quote you in here?
He does. So the third part of the lecture acknowledges that the structure of the four levels of intentional consciousness may prove open at both ends. So let me just read from what he says here on page 400, and then we can take our break. The intellectual operator that promotes our operations from the level of experience to the level of understanding. So experience, the intellectual operator is the question, like, what is it? Okay, that promotes us from experience to understanding, may well be preceded by a symbolic operator that coordinates neural potentialities and needs with higher goals through its control over the emergence of images and affects, which is exactly what I was talking about in psychic conversion. All right, so there's that symbolic operator that elevates the process out of the unconscious. Neural process is unconscious, okay? But elevates it out of that into consciousness through image and affect. So that's one. And that he did, he's right, that emerged for him as a result of our conversations. And then again, beyond the moral operator at the higher end that promotes us from judgments of fact to judgments of value with their retinue of decisions and actions, there is a further realm of interpersonal relations and total commitment. So in which human beings tend to find the imminent goal of their being, and with it their fullest joy and deepest peace. So it's the being in love. Okay. So from an intentionality analysis distinguishing four levels, one moves to an analysis that distinguishes 6 levels. The only place where he's said that. He has said 5 a couple of times, but 6 here. So, and maybe he wasn't sure of it, and maybe that's why he didn't want to give this paper and chose to give another one. I don't know. But anyway, I like it. All right, let's break for 5. I think I hear motion out in the corridor, so we can go out and move with them.
Can I ask just a quick question about the psyche? Like, is my understanding correct that it's that dramatic aesthetic pattern in consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. So do we not talk about the psyche at all in unconsciousness?
Well, see, it depends on what you mean by unconscious. Later in the next paper, Horizons and Transpositions, mm-hmm. what he earlier called the tidal movement or the passionateness of being is now, he says, what a lot of people call the unconscious. So see, for him, for Lonergan, the meaning of the term unconscious is actually different from what it is for, let's say, Freud and Jung. Lonergan maintains that what Freud and Jung called the unconscious was conscious, but not clearly conscious.
Yeah.
Okay. So, in other words, he would say there's no such thing as unconscious anger, for instance. There's you may not know that you're angry, but if it's anger, it's something in your self-presence. So it is conscious in that sense. So he uses the word differently. And it was a tremendous illumination to me after I had arrived at the psychic conversion stuff and talked with him about it, to hear him say in Boston in 74 that he thinks one of the problems here is that the German word for consciousness is Bewusstsein, which literally means to be known. All right? So there's a tendency to identify consciousness and knowledge. But for Lonergan, consciousness and knowledge are two quite distinct things. You can be conscious and in error, or you can be conscious and say, I don't know. Or you can be conscious but not know that you know.
Cognitive impairs.
Yeah. And what Carl Rogers' therapy does, for instance, and Lonergan found that very instructive for his own position, is that Rogers helps people identify feelings that they have, but they didn't know they had them. So, but if they're feelings, there's a self-presence, and for Lonergan, that's consciousness. And then so the therapy enables them to identify. Well, previously, and focusing is the same thing. Mm-hmm. Focusing exercises, you're identifying what is already operative but covered over, obscure in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
So what is unconscious for Lonergan is everything in the universe that's not present to itself.
Mm.
And everything in us that isn't present to itself. Our neural system is basically unconscious unless something goes wrong with it. And then we feel pain. Same with the circulation of our blood. It's unconscious unless there's a problem. You know? Or if we get excited or something like that. But otherwise, most of the time, it doesn't come into consciousness. So it's a different use of the term. So psyche for him and for me would be conscious.
Yeah.
And it would be
patterned in the sensor, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And it's what brings the unconscious into consciousness, mm-hmm. in the form of affective image,
mm-hmm.
first. Sensation, affect, image.
Mm-hmm.
The symbolic operator. It's one way of talking about it. It's not the only way of talking about it, but if you the way I got into it was through dreams, and that was symbolic operator. That's why I used the term symbolic operator in subject and psyche. So that's where he got to. All right, let's
thank
break
you.
For But see, interestingly enough, then after he read my stuff, he gave me Jenlin's book, Focusing, which he said is a lot easier way into this stuff than what I was talking about. But he said he's talking about the same thing you're talking about. And he is, but you don't have to go through years of dream analysis.
But I've tried that. You know, it's not that easy to focus.
It isn't. No, it's not. It isn't.
Which, you know, sometimes you find when you're running around and you haven't paid attention to yourself, and then one day you say, well, how do you do it to yourself? Sometimes, you know, stuff just comes out. All of a sudden, whoa, I didn't know that.
All right.